Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Sports Tonight on BSL Radio. Join Rob Shields and Mike Weber as they talk about the Baltimore Orioles, Baltimore Ravens, University of Maryland Terrapins, and more. Be part of the show. Call us at 347-215-8391.
Welcome to Sports Tonight with Rob and Mike. Mike Weber here with Rob Shields. Tonight we have a couple guests coming on. Matt Kremnitzer from Camden Depot. Talk some O's with Matt. And then after him, Michael Pina from Sports on Earth. Does a little bit of work for Grantland as well. He's an NBA guy. So plenty of NBA stuff to get into with Michael. Rob, let's start off with some O's talk. Relatively inactive offseason continues. But, now I guess we have, the Duquette situation behind us. They did make the trade for Snyder. That's a guy who has some potential to be solid. I think we talked about him maybe briefly last week or the week before that. What are your just general thoughts here as we approach spring training here?
Well, one of the things with our guest tonight, Matt, that we'll discuss and something that we've talked about on the message board a lot lately is the Pecota rankings of the Orioles in terms of their predictions of wins. And, a lot of people are upset about them. And just in general, a lot of the prediction systems, not showing a lot of love to the Orioles, and they haven't the last few years. And, I can see why people get upset about it because, they just feel the team is getting disrespected and that type of stuff. But I think, as long as people understand that these systems, they have their flaws, and one of the major flaws on them is that we still just don't know how to rate defense. And the defense on this team, as good as it's been the last few years, I think it has a chance to be the best that we've seen from the Orioles in this current run. Now, we'll have to that'll assume that Manny is going to play the full season, and that the elbow injury to Wieters is not the surgery and all is not going to be so prohibitive that he's just can't throw anybody out or anything like that. Even though I think that's a little overrated, but. but aside from those things and aside from Hardy's back being like a real, real big problem throughout the year, I really think that this team defensively is going to be incredibly good. Scope has lost some weight because he wants to be an even better defender. That was at least one of the reasons is he thought it would help improve his range some. So, and he was really good at second base last year. So, there's a chance that he's even better. We'll see what happens if Davis has improved himself at all. But, you have three of your four infielders are probably going to be legitimate Gold Glove candidates this year. Matt Wieters is obviously going to be a Gold Glove candidate. And I think our outfield defense is better this year than it has been. Travis Snyder, they haven't really said. I think the assumption is that he's going to play right field. The advanced metrics, however much weight you want to put into him, do say he's actually a better left fielder than right fielder. so we'll kind of see how that plays out. I don't know what kind of arm he has. I don't remember. So, if the guys like Diaz and those types of guys have stronger arms in right, then maybe you end up putting them in right field and keep Snyder in left. We'll see. But I think the outfield defense is going to be better. We'll see if Adam Jones will continue listening to coaches, the positioning and things like that, if those things continue to be good. But I continue to think that defense is the number one thing about this team. And I also think that's one of the reasons that the systems just the prediction systems just don't predict great things for this team because they just don't know how to measure that properly. So, I think we're looking at a very similar team that we've had the last couple of years. It's going to be a lot of close games, home runs, low on base, pitching's going to probably outperform, you know, what all the stat guys think it should because in large part because of that defense. So I think they're a good team. I think they've got a legitimate playoff chances, and I think they have a few X factors both in the lineup and in the rotation that if those X factors end up being, you know, big positives, then this team has a chance to be, you know, one of, if not the best team in all of baseball.
Yeah, so while, you know, it's certainly possible that these projection systems are undervaluing defense, you know, it depends on what stats you're using. I don't know for each different projection system or anything like that. But, you know, on Fangraphs, the Orioles were rated the second best defense last year with UZR behind the Royals. So they were given a ton of credit for their defense in terms of using advanced statistics. Some other defensive stats loved the Orioles defense as well. So, you know, again, I don't know how that's implemented into the projections, but it's not like advanced stats are, you know, missing a huge thing here with the defense. I mean, maybe it's underestimating how good the defense is, but, you know, second best in baseball is, you know, I think that's, you know, pretty generous. So, not to say that they don't deserve it, but I don't see, you know, a huge case to be like, oh, they're being underrated. Maybe you can say it's worth some more runs, perhaps. But, you know, overall with this Picota thing, I don't see, like, why people get so upset about it. First off, most of us Orioles fans also underestimated the Orioles these past three seasons. So we're going to get all up in arms because of Picota underestimating the Orioles. Hey, I underestimated the Orioles for much of this three-year run. I think you did. I think most Orioles fans, most of the fans over on BaltimoreSportsAndLife.com, where there's a discussion about this and where, you know, it's based off of, I believe, our very own Jeff Long. Jeff Long writes for Baseball Prospectus, but it was one of his colleagues, I think, wrote something for Baseball Prospectus on this. I haven't had a chance to read that article. But either way, you know, people, regardless of, you know, going off the systems or not, have been underestimating the Orioles the last 3 years. And, you know, there's various things to that. Some good points are brought up on BaltimoreSportsLife.com. You know, additionally to the defensive point you bring up, you know, Buck Showalter does an excellent job. Him and Duquette combined do a great job of managing those last few roster spots. So you get more productivity from those spots than most teams probably do. That's a factor. You have some guys that have, you know, been surprises. Obviously, Steve Pierce was a surprise last year. Miguel Gonzalez originally was a huge surprise. So various other guys. But, you know, overall, I just don't see, you know, a huge reason to get all defensive about Picota or to start, like, going off on people who use these projection systems. You know, every projection system or every person that tries to predict the baseball season is going to be wrong about a lot of stuff. So, you know, these systems, I think, are a pretty good tool to use. You don't want to take them as gospel by any means, but, you know, it's definitely useful.
Yeah, and I do like the systems when discussing individual players. I do think they have a lot of use there. You know, it's just, you know, and I'll, you know, give credit to what Chris Stoner said today, the, you know, owner of the Baltimore Sports and Life and everything. You know, he made the comment that, you know, it's great to use them as an individual basis, but when you have to take all those individual pieces and you put them together and you make a team, you can't just say, well, this is what it came out as a player, so this is what they come out as a team. There's just a lot of factors there. I mean, you brought up Showalter's managing. Who knows what that is worth? It might be worth nothing. It could be worth a lot. You know, we just have – I mean, here's what we know. This team is drastically different in terms of confidence, in terms of everything, since they've had Showalter versus before. Even the one season that we had him and you know, he had that good end of the season and then we sucked in 2011, and then since then they've been good. Even that season – there was still a difference with the team in terms of how they seemed to carry themselves and all versus the way they had been previous to that. So how much is that stuff worth? We have no idea. But it's a factor, for sure. And there's no way that Picota or Zips or any of these other projection systems have that factored in, because there's no way they can. And, you know, and then again, the defense. There's just no way. And then, you know, you've talked about it so many times, how relievers don't get enough, like, respect from, a statistics like WAR or something like that. So are they factoring in the importance of great bullpens and winning games by 1-2 runs and, you know, things like that, close games that you're always able to pull out? Now, some of that is luck. There's no doubt about it. But some of those types of things, you know, I just don't think there's enough level of respect put into them in these projection systems. And a lot of that isn't the fault of the projection system. It's just those things just can't be measured. And let's face it, they're putting numbers into a computer and spitting them out in, you know, simulations and things like that. And those things you can't put into those computer systems. And, you know, people will say that that takes the fun out of it and stuff like that. And I can see how some people could say that. But I think you have to understand what the system is trying to give you and what it's trying to provide. And you know, with a lot of teams, there might be a lot of validity to the system itself. But I think that there are going to be certain teams, and the Orioles are certainly one of them. The Kansas City Royals are probably another one, where, you know, the PECOTA readings on what it says, there are so many factors that you just – that they don't get taken into account that affects what the numbers say. And as long as you keep that in mind, then a rational discussion about them can be had. It's just when those things aren't kept in mind and people kind of take them a little overboard.
Sure. And I mean, I do think that the team projections are useful. I think it's useful to look at the team projections, you know, especially for teams that you don't pay as much attention to. But, you know, you look at those projections and then you make your own adjustments. And, you know, I don't see, you know, why that's like a bad thing to use these. I think they're pretty useful. They show obviously every single guy on the roster and what they're projected to do. And, you know, they're not going to be totally accurate. No, again, no one's going to be totally accurate. So I could be listening to, you know, some sports radio guys or you, Rob, or whatever, making predictions, and, you know, there's going to be plenty of problems with those predictions at the end of the season. So just because you or I or whomever is, like, way off on a few teams, that doesn't mean, like, oh, well, there's no point of even, like, paying attention to their opinion. So it's – I just think it's overblown. Yeah, just there's certain issues with the Orioles that maybe you know, should be accounted for, and they're not, that's fine. Then you account for them yourself. Just go, all right, well, I think, you know, Buck Showalter and Dan Duquette, they're with their management of the back end of the roster, right? And along with the great defense and, you know, whatever other factors you want to put out there, I think that's, you know, a reason why Pecota's undervaluing them. And then, you know, make your prediction off of that. No problem at all. I don't see, like, the reason for getting, you know, kind of defensive about this. And, you know, there's some talk on BSL about people, you know, not enjoying actual sports because they just, all they are is like number crunchers. And I think, you know, there's probably a few people like that, I guess. But, you know, I think that's largely ridiculous. And, you know, I don't see. And then there's also, I'm sorry, there's also, you know, a point that Chris Ricker made, who's been on the show multiple times, so saying that, you know, there are people that just, like, basically treat these as gospel, and then he gets tired of that, like, you know, type of position. But, you know, again, I think that's kind of overblown in terms of PECOTA, in terms of people using WAR, any advanced statistics in general. I think it's overblown. And by the way, he's using KenPom, talking about college basketball, like, 10 times a day on the board. So, you know, that's a little ironic. Anyway. I've rambled on enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think what it is, you know, I'm sure that, I mean, I don't read the message boards for the Tampa Bay Rays and, you know, St. Louis and, you know, anybody else. But, you know, Orioles fans are tired of seeing people just totally diss their team in their eyes. Now, don't get me wrong. I think, you know, people have hated the word luck when talking about the Orioles. The Orioles have had a lot of good fortune. I mean, they've had some bad fortune, but they've also had a lot of good fortune. And that's going to happen with any team that wins the amount of games that the Orioles have been winning over the last 3 years. So you're, there's always some level of luck, but people still hate to hear that word. And I think it's just Orioles fans just don't believe that any of these projection systems or any of these sites or anybody is giving them any level of respect. And I don't, and that's not, you know, when you read the articles that people are writing, whether it's an analyst, whether it's just some columnist for, you know, a Boston newspaper or whatever, all of them are mentioning the Orioles as either the favorite or one of the favorites in the American League East and in general the American League. So the projection systems are a computer-generated thing that gives you some insight and whatnot, but the people who watch the game are also giving you that insight. So, you know, at the end of the day, you can take which one you prefer. You know, some of these guys who are writing about things, let's face it, they're not really that good. And, you know, and some of the projection systems, you know, it's not that they're not good, they just have flaws. So, you know, that's just something that has to be taken into account. So I think a lot of it is just Oriole fans and just them just being upset because a computer system's not giving them their team the respect that they deserve. And, you know, that's I don't mind debating the merits of Pecota, but, you know, when you start kind of getting into stuff like that, I think that's just a little much, but, you know, people, I can understand it on some level as well.
I think you're right that people dislike the word luck in these instances. You know, variance may be a better word that people would not be as offended by, I guess. So, you know, Orioles, there's been some positive variance in their favor in these two playoff runs, especially 2012, that first, you know, two-thirds or so of the season. There was, you know, a lot of positive variance, or however you want to put it. And, you know, then they actually played legitimately really, really good baseball the remainder of the season. But, you know, it's there's also some of, like, the old concept of, all right, I can, like, make fun of my brother or whatever, but you can't. So the Orioles fans on, you know, Baltimore Source of Life, and I'm sure other places, have been, like, super down on the Orioles for the most part this offseason because not much has happened. But, you know, if other people say, like, oh, well, maybe this team's going to take some steps back, and then it's like, oh, you get all defensive because other people are attacking. But I guess... But yeah, so that makes sense, but you know, it's a little much from my point of view.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a little hypocritical. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And I have to say, I mean, I've recently for Baltimore Sports and Life written three articles about the rotation, the bullpen, and the position players. And I have to say that, like, after I kind of wrote each article, I ended up thinking a little more highly of each unit and the team in general than I had originally thought I was going to when I sat down. But, you know, but when I really go back and think about it, it to me, it really goes back to the defense of this team. And I just think, I mean, we have seen some excellent defense from the Orioles over the last 3 years, but I think if healthy, now, which is of course a big if, especially with the left side of our infield and the issues that they've had. But if healthy, I mean this team could have. It's not over the top to say that this team could have five Gold Glovers, like legitimate Gold Glovers, this season. I really think that's possible, and that's pretty amazing. And this team has really got, you know, the defensive upside of incredibly elite. And, you know, that just is going to make everything, in my opinion, like, so, I mean, it's not going to make our offense really any better, but it's going to make everything else, like, better. And that is really huge for this team, I think.
Are you including Adam Jones in that five count?
Well, I mean, at least the UCR actually liked him last year. Now, I do expect him to take a little bit of a step back, but we'll see. I mean, I think the positioning, you know, we never heard for sure. It's just been like what everybody has kind of theorized about it. But I mean, you know, he was a legitimate good defensive player last year. Now, I don't know if he was Gold Glover, but he was at least above average last year, at least if you look at the stats. And he certainly seemed to get to more balls last year than he had before. And I'm sure the positioning is more the reason, not because of range. But, I mean, you know, he at least deserved to be in the argument last year, whereas in the previous years when he's won the Gold Glove, he shouldn't have even been in the argument. So, I mean, if he continues that, he's at least a guy that is legitimately in the argument at the very least.
I mean, I would say he was better, but I don't know if he's really in the so much in the argument. I mean, that's very high standard center field Gold Glove, but yeah, he was better. All right, but let's welcome our guest to the show, Matt Kremnitzer. Did I say that right, Matt?
Yeah, that's right.
All right, Matt. So from Camden Depot, a very good site to check out Orioles analysis on. How you doing tonight, Matt?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Not bad. So, Matt, first things first, one guy that is a key to the Orioles' 2015 season is Ubaldo Jimenez, who obviously was very, very disappointing in his first year in Baltimore. So how optimistic are you that there will be a bounce back for Ubaldo?
I think he could be decent next year. I'm not expecting him to be amazing, but I don't think he'll be nearly as bad as last season either. I wouldn't be surprised if he started the season in the rotation then moved to the bullpen, or even if he for some reason started in the bullpen and then moved to the rotation. But I think they're going to give him every chance that they can for him to be in the rotation and to succeed after the money that they paid him. I think he'll be decent. I don't know who he should push from the rotation. They have a tough decision to make. But I wouldn't be surprised if he was not bad next season.
Yeah, I think Rob and I both have some optimism for a bounce back. I know Rob wrote about that for Baltimore Sports and Life in his starting rotation article. But, you know, you mentioned a key thing there in terms of if Ubaldo starts in the rotation from day one, who do you bounce out of the rotation? So, you know, you said it's a tough decision. Do you have any thoughts? Are you leaning a certain direction on that if they have to choose one of those starters?
If they end up not trading anyone, I'm sad to say they'll probably send Gausman down. I know fans don't want that. I don't think that should happen either. But that's the one move that they can make. He has an option left, I think. I guess you could move Gonzalez to the bullpen. I would probably favor that over sending Gausman down. But I think they would send Gausman down before that.
And Rob's a big fan of the idea of just trading one of these starters because of this situation. So would you advocate for that?
I wouldn't have a problem if they traded Norris or Chen, or maybe even Gonzalez, but he has a bunch of team-controlled years that are pretty cheap, and Chen and Norris will probably be gone after this season if the Orioles don't resign them. I would be fine with trading either one. It doesn't even matter, really. They'd probably rather trade Norris because he's right-handed. They like the Chen being left-handed. So a trade could be a decent option, sure.
Matt, assuming that a deal has been out there for one of those guys that you just named that would, you know, whether it's prospects or guys to help you now, do you think the Orioles would have made a mistake this offseason by not trading one of those guys? Or do you think it's definitely defensible to say, you know what, you're going to need more than five starters, so let's just keep the guys we have and just stick with that as the plan?
I think that's a fine plan, but I am not a fan of them sending Gausman down. I think he should be in the rotation from day one unless he's terrible or he gets hurt or something. If a trade leads to Gausman staying in the rotation, I think that's fine. But you can make a case for keeping six starters because they get hurt. I mean, Ubaldo got hurt last year. That's why he ended up in the bullpen besides pitching poorly. But, if they keep five, that's fine. If they keep six, I mean, that's fine. But I would probably rather trade than send Gausman down. Yeah, definitely.
Do you think it's reasonable to say that the reason that they didn't make a trade is because they just have no idea what they're going to get out of Jimenez?
I think that's fair, yeah. And I don't know if they know for sure what they're going to get from Gausman yet either. He was fantastic towards the end of last season, and he was lights out in the playoffs too. But in terms of going five, six innings, you know, every fifth day, I'm not sure if they believe they can rely on him for that. And I also think they want to give Ubaldo every chance they can give him to make the money that they're paying him.
Okay, let's move to the offensive side of things. What are your – when last year the Orioles, as we all know, they brought up Scope, played him all year. Offensively, he was pretty terrible. sub 600 OPS. He hit for some power, but he had a walk rate of like next to nothing, and you know the batting average wasn't there, all that kind of stuff. But defensively, he was really good. You know, this offseason he's lost a little bit of weight. He talked about wanting to gain a little bit more range, have a little bit more speed on the bases. He actually is hoping to lose a little more weight in spring training. So what are your expectations for him offensively this year? Do you see him being able to take a little bit of a leap and be more of a total all-around league average or better second baseman?
I could see him taking a step forward offensively and maybe a little bit of a step back defensively. I don't think he can be nearly as bad as he was last year offensively with such a low on base percentage. I was a bit surprised towards the end of last season they didn't trade for a second baseman as they were making the playoff push and solidifying their spot in the East. I think they could use more help offensively, or they could have. There's every reason to give him a chance, especially at the start of this season, to see what he can do. But yeah, I do think he could take a step forward. And I'm not sure if he's quite as good defensively. He's really good at turning double plays with Hardy. I don't know how good his range is exactly. He does have a very strong arm. But, yeah, offensively, I think he'll take a step forward, sure.
If the rumored trade in the offseason that the Angels had called and for Chen for Howie Kendrick, and forgetting the fact that if we could have flipped Kendrick for Andrew Haney like is what happened, would you have advocated that move, or would you have rather kept Chen or traded him in another deal and kept Scope as your everyday second baseman?
I probably would have kept Scope. It's very intriguing. I think Kendrick is a free agent after the season, if I'm not mistaken. And so is Chen. But I do think it's nice to have one lefty in the rotation instead of having five right-handed starters, if anyone cares about that. But I'm okay with sticking with Scope at the beginning of this year, this upcoming year. But if he does struggle, you know, really badly defensively, you know, they may have to look for another second baseman, especially depending on how they're doing around the trade deadline or before then even.
All right, so Matt, another key offensive player for the Orioles is, of course, Chris Davis. He batted 196 last year, 300 on base percentage, 404 slugging. Terrible season for him. Of course, ended the year with the Adderall suspension, which is going to continue into the beginning of this season. Are you optimistic that he will, you know, probably not get back to 2013 levels, but at least, you know, maybe between that and 2012 level?
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, pretty much exactly. I don't think he's ever going to be as good as he was in 2013 again. But that's okay. I mean, he can still be an offensive force, and he can give them some of the power that they will probably be looking for with Nelson Cruz gone. I don't think he'll be back after the season. If he has a good enough season, then they could offer him the qualifying offer. I think that would be reasonable. But I think he will be better. I don't know how good, but I don't think there's any way he'll be as good as 2013 or as bad as he was in 2014 either. I agree with you.
Matt, do you think it's reasonable to expect what he did in 2012, but maybe with a little bit better on base since he's walking more now?
Yeah,
or is that
definitely
too much?
I agree.
Okay, let's move on to the Pecota projections for the team. That's been a topic of conversation over on Baltimore Sports and Life, and we've got some people not happy about it because they're only projecting 78 wins. So when you see a projection system, whether it's Pecota or Zips or any other ones, what are your thoughts on how they come up with like the team wins, setting aside what they do for individual players? Do you think that this is a really good tool to look at? Do you think it's a flawed tool? What are your thoughts on it?
It's certainly not a perfect tool, but I think it's useful. I honestly don't pay a whole lot of attention to projection systems. They do have their use, and I think it's fine to talk about them, and not everyone's going to be happy, especially when your team is low on the win totals as the Orioles. I don't think they're going to be that bad. I think they underestimate some of the talent the Orioles do have, especially in the pitching staff who keep overperforming projections, I think, for a couple years now. Maybe that's some sort of Buck Showalter factor. I don't know. I'm not really sure. I mean, it can't account for everything. But it is worth talking about it. I'm not just going to dismiss, you know, something I don't completely understand. But I do think the Orioles will be better than that. And maybe not quite as good as last season, maybe second or third place. I'm not sure if they're as good as the Red Sox and the Blue Jays. But I still think they'll be a pretty decent team.
Do you think it's fair to say that some of these projection systems don't predict the Orioles as well as maybe they should, because one of the main components of this team is the defense, and defense isn't really measured properly at this point in time?
Yeah, that could be a factor. It's also that they're not really a high strikeout team. They aren't really a high ground ball team either. They get a lot of fly balls. And then Camden Yards, you usually think that would lead to trouble. But for some reason, the last couple of years, it really hasn't. And the starting rotation has exceeded expectations. I'm not really sure why. The same thing is going on with Miguel Gonzalez. No one can really understand where he came from, how he's able to keep putting up the numbers that he has. I think Steve Mallucci was talking about this the other day. He compared him to James Shields for some reason, which is interesting. But, I think they can still be decent. And, I'm not really sure what exactly that the projection systems are missing, but I'm pretty happy as an Orioles fan about it.
So, Matt, Manny Machado, obviously a great young talent. How concerned are you about his knees?
I'm pretty concerned. Two season-ending knee injuries is definitely a problem. I think he'll still have a nice season, but long-term, I don't know if that's someone you give an extension to. You buy out his arbitration years. I don't think I would do that right now, even though some fans are still calling for it because it would be cheap. I think you might need to see him on the field, play a significant chunk of a season or two before you even start talking about that. But I do think he'll be pretty good. He's always excellent defensively. It'll be interesting to see where his offensive numbers are. He's been slowly ticking up offensively. And if he's healthy this year, I think he can have a really solid season.
So, like, by really solid season, what types of numbers are you thinking?
I don't think he'll be a hit around 300, maybe 280, 330 or 340 on base, and maybe a decent amount of power. I don't think he'll be amazing or anything, but with the level of defense that he gives the Orioles, even a decent uptick offensively is a really good player to have.
Do you see, you say you don't think he's going to be amazing, but do you see at least the potential there for an offensive breakout?
It's been hard to tell with the injuries the last couple of seasons. But I'm not sure if the power will ever get there, but he does hit the ball pretty hard when he makes contact. The plate discipline is also sort of a problem. He's been up and down, but he's still young enough, and he's definitely talented enough. And the only factor for me really is if he can stay on the field.
Matt, you mentioned that you weren't sure if the Orioles were as good as Toronto and Boston. What are your general thoughts about the division as we head into spring training right now?
I think the Orioles are clearly in the class of the Red Sox and the Jays. I think they're better than the Yankees and Rays. So I'd probably put them second or third. I do think the Blue Jays made some very smart trades and some smart signings this offseason. They probably had, them and the Red Sox had two of the best offseasons in baseball. I do think the Orioles are being a little overlooked because they didn't make any big splashes, but they do have Machado and Davis and Wieters. And I know people keep saying that, but those are, three really good players, and they can make a big impact if they're healthy. And that's going to be, health is going to be something that's a make or break for them this year. If those guys can stay healthy, they may have a very good season.
Did you feel that the Orioles should have done more this offseason, or did you think that this was an offseason that wasn't really worth going after many of the guys who were available?
I think that what they did is fine. I don't know why they didn't sign Rasmus instead of trade for Snyder, though I do like Snyder. I was fine with letting Markakis go. The same with Miller and Cruz, really. I had no problems with those moves. They're kind of stuck. 2015 is a make-or-break year for them because they have so many players scheduled to be free agents. So there's a case to be made where they should have going after maybe one of the higher priced free agents. But I don't think that makes a lot of sense for them, getting stuck in a long term deal when they may be in a team that they may be a team who looks completely different next year anyway. And so you don't want to lock yourselves into some long term deals with aging players who may not be good down the road anyway. I think it's fine to gamble on Weeders and Machado and health and stuff like that. So I'm fine with what they did. It doesn't look very good considering everything that went on with Duquette. But I think they made the right decision, though they may not have looked like they were going to do that from the beginning.
All right, Matt. Good thoughts from you. Of course, you're from Camden Depot, a very good site for Orioles fans to check out. So, you know, go ahead, tell me where you're at on Twitter and, you know, talk about Camden Depot for a moment.
You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Krednitzer, and you can follow Camden Depot's posts and everything on Twitter at Camden Depot. We usually try to have a post up every day. I'm not sure what the topic is for tomorrow yet, but it's usually something different. And, yeah, thank you guys for having me on.
Our pleasure, Matt. Thanks for coming on. We greatly appreciate it, and have a great night.
Okay, you too. Thanks.
Yep. All right, so that was Matt Krednitzer from Camden Depot. Good site there to check out O's analysis, as well as our own site, Baltimore Sports and Life, featuring Rob Shields, the co-host here. So, Rob, any feedback there, or not feedback, but reaction to what Matt said?
This isn't necessarily to what Matt said, but just in the general feeling of the people that we've had on over the time. I don't think Machado has given enough credit for his offensive upside. Now Matt did say, you know, he recognizes there could be a breakout there or anything, but generally speaking, it surprises me on how it just doesn't seem like most people feel that Machado really has this really good, however you want to define very good, offensive upside, you know, and whatever. I mean, I had thought that I think he's going to have, if he's healthy, I think he's going to get his OPS around 800 or a little bit more this year. You know, we started last year seeing a little bit more of an increase in the walk rate. We saw some of the doubles from the year before become homers last year. And you know, let's not forget, the first month that he played last year, he was terrible, and a lot of that had to do with the fact that he was coming back from that knee injury. The second month, he had a solid month. I want to say the OPS was around 780 for the month of June last year, and then he just blew up. It was like 900 in the other couple months. So I just don't think he's given quite enough credit. I can understand wanting to wait and see, and I can understand wanting to see if the knee injuries are going to impact him. But I we've had other guests on before, and it just seems like people – don't give Machado enough credit. I mean, the guy should be a 280 to 310 hitter. I think most years he can go, he can use all fields well. He's going to be able to have power, and I think the walk rate is going to get better. I don't think it's going to ever be elite, but if he can get it to 6 to 8% and he's walking 50, 60 times a year, I would be happy with that, because the rest of his game should be pretty good, because he's going to hit for a high average, so he's going to at least be able to still be a 340, 350, 360 on base guy, I think. I don't think he's ever going to be a 390 to 420 on base guy, but, you know, a lot of those guys are also not going to hit for his power and or not have his elite glove either. So he's going to be able to make up for that in other areas in terms of his overall value.
I agree. His last 2 years, basically the same in OPS, 756 in 2013 and 755 last year. But you have to take into consideration that his on-base percentage was 10 points higher last season. So that's more important than the slugging. And the offense in baseball went down. So his WRC plus, for instance, was a 111 last year compared to 102 in 2013. So he did get better offensively last year, and I do think that he should get better again this year, assuming some decent health. Let's change gears here, though. Michael Pinna from Sports on Earth is now joining the show. How you doing tonight, Michael?
Good. How are you guys?
Not bad. Did I get the last name right?
Pina, but you were close enough.
Ah. Pina. All right, my bad. All right, so, Michael, lots to get into in terms of NBA basketball here. So first off, let's start off with what's been, you know, a pretty major story of late, the situation with LeBron and Kevin Love and the tweet and all that. So what do you make of this drama going on?
So, I mean, it's pretty weird, right? They've been extremely successful the past couple of weeks, 9-1 in their last 10 games. And LeBron basically just sends this tweet out kind of out of nowhere, taking a shot at, I guess you could call it a shot, at Kevin Love and his inability to fit in with the team structure. I think he had 2 5-point outings recently before the tweet. But it's just really strange. And Love will opt out of his contract this summer for financial reasons alone. And it makes you really think about where he'll end up next season. It shouldn't really surprise anybody if he's not in Cleveland, especially if they struggle in the postseason this year.
Yeah, based off of how things are going, that wouldn't be shocking. And the fit-in comment may also be referring to, you know, off-the-court stuff, because apparently Kevin Love is an incredible introvert and, you know, LeBron, you know, wants his teammates to go out more or whatever. But in terms of the on-the-court stuff, how do you think the Cavs should be using Kevin Love?
When I first heard that he was going to be joining the team, I figured it would be a ton of pick and rolls with him and LeBron, him and Kyrie, and that just really hasn't been the case. They stick him in the corner. He gets a few post touches, but he just kind of hovers on the perimeter and doesn't really isn't able to impact the game in terms of grabbing offensive and defensive rebounds as he did in Minnesota, and that's kind of what made him such a special player. So it would be great, I think, if they could kind of utilize him more as a pick and roll weapon. I don't know if that's in the cards or what, but that's what I personally would like to see a little bit more.
Yeah, that makes sense. So based off of what we're seeing this year with Kevin Love, do you think, you know, it's showing that he was perhaps overrated with the Wolves, or is it just an issue of the Cavs not using him correctly?
I still think he's a star. I think fit is a really big part of NBA success. And when he played for a team that kind of needed him to do everything, he was able to do it, strictly speaking about his offensive abilities. Defensively, we always knew that he was a limited player, and those weaknesses really they shine through this season, especially before the Mozgov trade when there was no real rim protector on the roster. I mean, the Timberwolves didn't make the playoffs last year for a reason. They didn't have any rim protection either. So Love kind of needs that when he's playing in a front court. He needs to be on a team with a defensive-minded big by his side. And the Cavs just got one, so that's a step up, but his defense is still a problem.
Yeah, definitely. So last question here on the Cavs, and, you know, speaking of fit, you recently wrote about, you know, how J.R. Smith has fit in with the Cavs. So, you know, how much better do you think they are? I mean, obviously it's showing on the court so far, but how much better overall do you think this team is with J.R. Smith and with Mozgov, who you mentioned, and Shumpert?
Well, I'm shocked that J.R. Smith has played so well, and I'm a little skeptical that he'll keep this up. Not that he can't shoot, or not that he's not a good 3-point shooter, because he is, but I think that when the team struggles, I think he might veer a little bit and look to do more things offensively than maybe David Blatt wants him to. So right now it's perfect and it's butter. He's just shooting threes and spacing the floor, and that's kind of what he should do for a good team. So Mozgov's been great as well, kind of just the big body that they've needed since Varejao went out for the season. And Shumpert's kind of feeling his way along. He hasn't really been the healthy peak Iman Shumpert that we saw in New York a couple of years ago yet, but he's finding his way back, and I think he'll be a big part of their playoff rotation.
going back to Kevin Love for a second, do you think the Cavs made a mistake by trading Wiggins for him?
I thought at the time that, yes, that they should have kept Wiggins and Anthony Bennett, even though Bennett's kind of been a total bust. But I just thought that not only was Wiggins going to be a very special two-way player, but the financial ability, the flexibility of having a number one draft pick, there's nothing better in the NBA than having the number one overall pick, right? Because it only costs between $5, $6 million, whereas Kevin Love, who has all these defensive problems, costs, I don't even know what he's making right now, $15 million, something like that, and he's a free agent next year, and you have to re-sign him. So having Wiggins under market value for the first 6-7 years of his career, I think that outweighed bringing in Love, just because you could then spend that money on a rim protector, on outside shooting, on wing defense, and that alone makes it more valuable. Not to mention that Wiggins looks like a very, very good player who's going to be very good in the future.
Okay, let's change gears here. Let's talk about the Clippers. You recently wrote about the impact of Griffin's injury, and so far, in obviously a small sampling of games, they're 2-1 without him. So, what are your expectations for the Clippers while Griffin is out?
Yeah, so they won their past two games, which kind of shocked me a little bit, beating the Rockets and the other team slips. Oh, the Mavericks. They beat the Mavericks because Monte Ellis and Tyson Chandler got hurt in the first quarter of that game. But I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest with you, if they slipped out of the playoff picture. They're just such a top-heavy, thin basketball team, and the West is so tough, and Griffin's so good, that if he's out for 5-6 weeks, longer than that, seeing them slip out of the playoffs altogether, just it wouldn't shock me.
And what did you think about the Clippers bringing in Austin Rivers? Was it just so he can play, so he can, you know, because his dad's the coach, or do you think it's a little bit more than that?
No, I think it's because his dad's the coach. yeah, that one's still, that's a head-scratcher to this day. And I don't think anybody knows why they made that trade. One of the worst trades that has happened in a few years, I think.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, he's really bad. Do you think that affects the locker room? I mean, because Doc's not just the coach, he's also the GM. So him to bring in Austin Rivers, who, you know, is actually playing. It's not like he's just sitting on the bench. Do you think that's, you know, a potential issue in the locker room where guys are kind of like questioning Doc here?
So I actually don't, because ironically, the move, Doc rationalized the move by he bought out Jordan Farmar and he traded Reggie Bullock, and he rationalized bringing in Rivers to actually improve the chemistry in the locker room because he didn't really like the energy that those guys were bringing. Whether or not that's true remains to be seen, but they've been a pretty good team since the Rivers trade. They haven't been terrible. I mean, they still have one of the best offenses in the league. I wouldn't have done that trade, but I don't think that guys are petty I would like to think that guys aren't that petty and aren't worried about a coach, like it's high school, a coach's son getting playing time when he doesn't deserve it.
All right, so Anthony Davis, unfortunately, dealing with an injury right now. But has anyone played better basketball thus far than Anthony Davis?
On both ends of the court, probably not. No, he's been fantastic this season. He's having a historical third year. He's a nightly, you got a DVR every single Pelicans game. He's wonderful. I think personally the best player in the league right now is James Harden, if I had to say one guy. But Davis has been fantastic. you really have to love everything he's doing, and that he seems to be getting better as the season goes on. So hopefully he can bounce back from the shoulder injury sooner than later.
So I assume James Harden would be your MVP right now?
He is. He's been my MVP since early December, I'd say. He's just been otherworldly this season. He's making guys around him better, dropping 40 points like it's nothing, and the team's defense has been fantastic, and that should not be overlooked. But Harden has just been, I mean, he just does things that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I mean, obviously amazing season, and he's, you know, actually putting in some effort on defense now, which is nice to see. But, you know, as far as the best player in the league conversation, which I always think is interesting, would you say James Harden is the best player in the league, or would you say he's playing the best right now? I think there is, I guess, a bit of a difference there.
No, you're right. There is a difference. I would still say that LeBron James is the best player in the league. I don't know where Harden would fall in that pecking order. He's probably somewhere in my top five. But, I mean, there's so many great players. I mean, you have Davis, LeBron, Durant, Steph Curry, so Chris Paul. So, I mean, there's so many great players, but right now, I mean, the best player alive is LeBron James, and he kind of has shown that since returning from that two-week sabbatical. I don't know what he did during those 2 weeks to get back in the proper condition, but yeah, he's the best player alive right now, I think.
Real quick on Anthony Davis, you know, as of right now, there's only one playoff spot that the teams are battling for in the Western Conference, so that's probably going to change. But as of right now, we're looking at Phoenix, the Thunder, and the Pelicans. Is Anthony Davis playing well enough that he can carry that team to the playoffs in that tough conference, or does he still need to get a lot more help?
Well, I think if you look at where they're at, they're 27 and 26 right now, and he's been a monster. So I think he clearly needs more help. I don't know how they're going to get it. I mean, there's been some disappointing performances on that roster. Omer Asik hasn't been the guy that they thought he would be. Eric Gordon's actually he's come to life after looking like a corpse earlier this season. But no, he definitely needs more help. I don't know how they're going to get it for him. And some of it is just out of his control. There's only so much one guy can do in a team game. You have the Oklahoma City Thunder, who have two of the 10 best players in the world, and the Suns, who I don't know if they're going to trade or keep Goran Dragic, but they're a very good basketball team. So Davis is doing all he can, and I don't know if it's enough.
So our semi-local team around here is the Wizards, and they've been struggling lately. They've got the Bradley Beal injury that they're dealing with and all. So outside of the Bradley Beal injury, which is relatively recent, what do you think their issues are right now?
That's a great question. I haven't watched too much of the Wizards lately, although Beal's one of my favorite young players, and to see him go down was that stings. But, I mean, offensively, they're about league average offensively since the new year, I think. And their potential on that end should be a little higher. Defensively, they've been solid all season long. But then, I don't know, like John Wall, I would like to see them play with more pace, to be honest with you. I think they're very effective when they're running up and down in transition, and sometimes that offense gets bogged down and bogged down in kind of an ugly half-court mess. Their starting five is very effective, or was very effective when Beal was healthy. The bench needs to play a little better. But the Wizards, the East is kind of wide open, I guess you could say, and the Wizards, I don't know if I would say that they have as good a shot as anybody, but I wouldn't be totally shocked if they made a run at the Eastern Conference Finals. You have to remember that their schedule in the first month was a cupcake. So this is just kind of a tougher – they're facing tougher teams now, and it's showing.
Well, speaking of the playoffs, they have an uphill battle to get a home court in at least in the first round of the playoffs. Do you think that – you know, that this team is destined for a one-and-done type situation? Or, I mean, I know you just mentioned that they could make a run. Do you feel that they, you know, they'll be able to push, you know, Cleveland and Chicago, Toronto, Atlanta in a series and be able to beat one or two of those teams?
I wouldn't, to be honest with you, I would not put money on it. But Washington's kind of like a team that's kind of built for a seven-game series, just with they're so big and they're old. They got veteran savvy guys that have been there before. So right now, I would not say that they could beat Cleveland or Chicago. They would not come out on top in a seven-game series if everybody's healthy on both ends. But, I mean, who knows with Washington or who knows with the East? Anything can really happen.
Speaking of the East, how real do you think the Atlanta Hawks are? And if you had to pick a favorite, would they be it?
Yeah, I'm a buyer of the Atlanta Hawks. I believe in everything that they're doing. I love their roster. I love the way they play. Would I say that they're a favorite? I preseason picked one at all was the Bulls, and I'm just kind of stubbornly hitching myself to that wagon until they're eliminated. But Atlanta's great, and I mean, I hope they go to the Eastern Conference Finals or the Finals. That'd be really cool.
And then in the Western Conference, the best team has obviously been Golden State. So what teams do you feel have the best chance of beating Golden State in the playoffs?
I mean, in the West, anybody can beat anybody. I mean, you have Oklahoma City. If Oklahoma City plays Golden State in the first round, is anyone going to be really shocked if the Thunder win? I don't think so. And I think the second-best team in that conference right now is the Memphis Grizzlies, and they've looked really – well, they've stumbled a bit of late, but they won 8 of their last 10, and they got trounced last night by the Thunder. But the Grizzlies are a real tough team. They've improved their offense over the last couple of years. Their defense is still nice. Zebo's having one of the best years he's had in a while. Marcus Gasol is a monster. And I really love the Jeff Green addition. He's fit in really well with them. So if I had to say one team that I think can emerge out of the West besides Golden State, I'd have to go with them right now.
And the one team you didn't mention was San Antonio. Where do you see them come playoff time in terms of where you in terms of how likely it is that they can repeat?
That's a good call. I should have mentioned San Antonio. Yeah, I mean, San Antonio's got as good a shot as anybody. They, as long as Kawhi Leonard is healthy and kind of replicates his NBA Finals performance through four straight playoff rounds. But they have problems too right now. They have injury problems, and Tony Parker is having an awful season by his standards. So until he can show he can and kind of play up to his normal expectations, and they get healthy, it's tough to pick them blindly kind of right now. But they are the Spurs, and the Spurs should not be disrespected.
No, they should not be. So, Michael, greatly appreciate you coming on the show. Let us know where you can be followed on Twitter as well as what you have going on right now.
So follow me on Twitter at Michael V. Pina, P-I-N-A. I'm actually writing a piece right now on Zebo and just kind of how valuable he's been to the Grizzlies this season. So that will be available some point over the next couple of days.
All right, and I assume on Sports on Earth, I know you sometimes write for other sites, but that's your main site.
No, this one's actually going to be for Bleacher Report.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad I asked then. All right, so Bleacher Report, also, yeah, Sports on Earth, you have some articles up there. So, you know, just, I guess, go on your Twitter account, and people will be able to, you know, find your work through there. But, yeah, check out the various sites that you're associated with, of course. Thanks, Michael, for joining the show. Yeah, we really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, guys. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye.
All right. Michael Pinna there from Sports on Earth, Bleacher Report, occasionally Grantland and other places. So I guess good thing I asked there where the article would be appearing. So, Rob, you know, what's your take on what Michael had to say?
You know, we talked about this recently, but it would really be a shame if Golden State and Oklahoma City play in the first round. I think it could be a shame if San Antonio and Memphis play in the first round, as is a possibility. I would love to see those four teams be in the next round, and then the winners of that are going to the, you know, to the conference finals. But he's right. I mean, if you're Golden State, you know, you can have they might win 65 games this year, and your reward for that is playing Oklahoma City, who by that time could possibly be one of the top five teams in the NBA, and that's your reward in the first round. That's really, really tough. And, you know, it's one of those things where it ends up being bad luck for Golden State that the Durant and Westbrook injuries happen, because, you know, without those, then obviously Oklahoma City is comfortably in, and, you know, that's not a consideration for those two teams to play in the first round. But, that's going to be, you know, I feel like we say it every year, like, God, I can't wait for the Western Conference playoffs, how great they're going to be. But, you know, this year might be the best, and it's going to be something else if those are the two teams in the first round.
Definitely. Regardless of who the eighth seed is, it's going to be a tough opponent for presumably Golden State. You know, Memphis is only four games behind, so they have a chance at taking the number one seed. But I think Golden State will end up being the number one seed. And if they do play Oklahoma City, you know, you say it'll be a shame, but it won't be a shame in terms of entertainment level. That would be most likely an amazing series. You know, two ridiculous heavyweights for a first-round series. And you're right that if Golden State is to lose that is just terrible luck for them, that they had to play such a good team. Not much of a reward for, you know, winning, you know, like you said, 65-ish games probably. So, you know, beyond that, you know, the West, just in general, obviously, it's hard to really predict what's going to happen. A lot of it's going to depend on matchups, I think. And, you know, he makes some good points, Michael did, about the Spurs. You know, Tony Parker, not quite himself. And, you know, they've been dealing with some injuries as a team. And, of course, Pop doesn't really push them super hard in the regular season. But I think you would like to see, you know, a little bit better play from them. They are on their rodeo trip right now. Now, obviously, being broken up by the All-Star game. And a lot of times that seems to help this team, and then kind of kick it into another gear with the rodeo trip and beyond. But, you know, I just don't know, like, what I think Golden State is the clear favorite, but, you know, if I were to put a percentage on it, it wouldn't be any, like, huge number, because all these other teams, I think, have a legitimate chance. I'm assuming Oklahoma City gets into the playoffs. Phoenix has been struggling lately, so, you know, take Phoenix out, put Oklahoma City in. I think that's your eight teams. I think the Clippers are still able to make the playoffs with the Blake Griffin situation. I think they're able to play well enough. I mean, they're six games up on the Suns right now. And, again, the Suns are struggling. So, and you mentioned New Orleans, you know, their fight for the playoffs. But I just don't think that team's good enough overall. And now you have the Anthony Davis injury as well. And he does get, you know, some nagging injuries here and there. So that's an issue for him. So I don't see that team really being a legitimate playoff threat either.
Yeah, the thing I kind of wonder, the teams that we're not talking about that much in the West, Portland, Houston, what are their chances of coming out of the conference? You know, we saw the LaMarcus Aldridge injury, and we thought he was going to miss a bunch of time and everything else. And all of a sudden, he played the next game, and he's been good. So the injury hasn't really hurt him that bad. Michael brought up how brilliant Harden has been, and you know now they're without Dwight Howard for 6 to 8 weeks or so, it appears, maybe a little bit less, but somewhere in that general area. Now, that's bad news right now, but I don't think that team is going to go into some rut. I mean, I guess that's the one thing. Does Houston or does the Clippers, do any of those teams, because they're without, you know, arguably their best players, are they going to all of a sudden go into some tailspin? And maybe they don't fall out of the playoffs, but maybe teams like Oklahoma City and San Antonio win, you know, go on some win 13 of 15 games, or, you know, some kind of long run like that. And all of a sudden, you know, those teams are the 7 and 8 seeds, and San Antonio of Oklahoma City have moved up. That's the type of thing I wonder. But if a guy like Dwight Howard, if he comes back, he's healthy, you know, he's going to also be rested. So that's the positive to this injury, is by playoff time, you know, he should be fully go, ready to go. Nobody's talking about those two teams. And, you know, you've got Howard and Harden are great players. They added Parsons in the offseason. You've got they lost Parsons. I don't know why I said that. they've got a quality team. You have Portland with, you know, Damian Lillard, who, you know, some people think might be the best point guard in the league now. And LaMarcus Aldridge is obviously a stud power forward. So, it's going to be interesting to see what this team is able to do and what those two teams are able to do in a conference where they're kind of overlooked, but they probably have the ability to go deep and maybe even make the finals.
Yeah, I think I'm not as high on Houston as most or some other people are. Charles Barkley got into a little bit with Daryl Morey, whatever his name is, on Twitter. And, you know, the Rockets GM, Morey, is a very, you know, advanced stat type of guy, analytics, while Charles Barkley basically said all that stuff is crap. So, obviously, I disagree with Charles in that regard, but he also mentioned that he didn't think the Rockets are a real contender. And, you know, I think they have a outside chance of, you know, making it to the finals, winning a title, but... And confidence level, they're pretty low on my list. Dwight Howard may have been on Grantland that they were talking about. Is he basically done as an elite player? And I think he might be. I mean, the athleticism now with this injury again to his knee, I don't know if he's going to be able to, you know, be that like a dominant athletic force that he used to be. And he's still a good player. Still very, very solid defensively, and he can do some things on offense, and he still has that good athleticism, of course, but I don't think he's dominant anymore, and he's not like a skilled enough player to continue to be a great player without the elite athleticism. So I worry about that this year, but especially going forward for the Rockets. And, you know, Harden, yeah, has been fantastic, but, you know, overall, I'm not super enamored by this team. I do like Portland better. The Lillard-Aldridge combo is very good. They have some shooting around those guys. I like Wes Matthews. They play some good defense over there. So that's a pretty good team. I would give them more of a chance than a lot of people would. I'm not very high on Dallas. The Clippers, we talked about them. I like the Clippers, but, you know, the wing positions are shaky, especially small forward. So I'm not confident in that. The Austin Rivers thing we talked about, Michael, to Michael about, you know, I don't know that it would, I don't think it would be petty necessarily for, you know, guys on the Clippers bench to, or on the Clippers team to have an issue with Doc bringing in his son and him playing if he doesn't really deserve to be playing. I think if a coach is playing anyone who shouldn't be playing, you know, the players have a right to be upset about that, but even more so when it's his son and when the coach is also the GM and is the one who made the trade for him and, like, was a trade that, like, basically everyone thought was super weird. And, you know, Austin Rivers just isn't good. I know he's a Dookie, so, you know, maybe you're partial to him, but it's that's a weird situation. So that's a little side topic, but I don't know. I would be kind of annoyed if I was on the Clippers.
Yeah, I mean, what is he doing well? I mean, he's only averaging 7 points a game so far in his young career. He's not a good defensive player. You know, in his time at Duke, you know, that was the season that they lost, one of the two recent seasons they lost in the first round. And the blame for that season was essentially put on him, that, you know, just the way his attitude was and, you know, his, I think the way he was in, like, their clubhouse and things like that. So he had that reputation. And then, now he was a good scorer in college, but, you know, he's not a good scorer in this league. He's not athletic. He's not overly athletic, I guess I should say. So, you know, that's going to struggle. And he's not, you know, I mean, he's got decent size, but nothing fantastic by any stretch. So I can see why players could be upset about that, because, you know, here you have a player who's really not that good. And if he's going to get significant minutes and take it away, and more importantly, take minutes away from guys who should be getting those minutes, that's where the problem is. You know, if he gets minutes in mop-up time and, you know, things like that, and, you know, he's got to spell a guy in foul trouble, whatnot, those types of things are different. But if he's getting real minutes and minutes that, you know, other bench players should be getting, that's when I think it can cause a problem. And I agree with you. That's not, to me, that's not being petty. That's saying, first of all, let's let the best players on the court. And second of all, we're in a ridiculously tough conference, and literally every game does matter, because, you know, you want to get that home court, or you want to, you know, you want to win your division, or whatever the case may be. You know, you don't want to be the, you know, you don't want to be the sixth seed and play, you know, this team in the first round. You would rather play that team in the first round, you know, stuff like that. So I think that all of that stuff matters, and that's not really being petty, in my opinion.
Yeah, and he's playing 19 minutes a game, and yeah, you mentioned 7 points a game, but which, you know, I guess isn't terrible, but for a guy in his type of role. But he shoots 39% for his career, 32% from three, 62% from the line. So he's not bringing much to the table. Like you said, he doesn't play good defense or anything. So yeah, that's a bad situation. But you know, I still give the Clippers somewhat of a chance overall in the West, due to Chris Paul, Blake Griffin once he comes back, Jordan, you know, dominating on the glass. He leads the league in rebounds, blocks a ton of shots, and he's just a physical freak. So he brings some good things. Obviously, the free throws are a huge issue, though. You mentioned Oklahoma City, you know, potentially getting up into, like, you know, the higher seed. I think they're probably going to be the 8th seed. We were talking about 30 games left in the season. The Thunder have 29 games left. They're 6 games behind the Spurs, 6.5 behind the Clippers, you know, 7 behind the Mavericks, and then more games behind everyone else. That's a good amount of games to make up in that time period, especially when, you know, we're talking about teams that are legitimately good. So maybe they can get to the 7th spot if the Clippers fall off some with this Blake Griffin situation. I think that's about the best they can do. And, you know, it's going to be tough for them to come from that spot, but I wouldn't be shocked, you know, with a team with, you know, Kevin Durant, who's in the conversation for best player in the league, and then Russell Westbrook, who has been fantastic, and then obviously, you know, Ibaka's a very good player for them, and Steven Adams, who's hurt right now, but he's developed. That's their one positive, really, from the Harden trade. So, you know, they have some pretty good pieces there, and when you have two legitimate, like, fantastic superstars, you have a shot.
Yeah, I mean, for Oklahoma City to get to that point, you know, you said that, so let's say they have 30 games left. I don't know the exact number, but let's say that's what it is. You know, at that point, it's kind of, can this team go 25-5, 23-7, something like that? I think you can have a lot of the teams in front of them play very solid basketball, but if the Clippers or the Spurs kind of are in the same boat here. If those one or both of those teams go on some ridiculous run where they win, you know, like I said, 15 out of 17 games or something like that, you know, you can be the Mavericks, for example, and in an 18-game stretch, you can go, you know, 10-8, 11-7, be playing good basketball. But Oklahoma City, if Oklahoma City wins 15 or 16 of those 18 games, now all of a sudden, maybe they've caught you or they're right there with you. So that's the type of thing. Oklahoma City's going to have to do that, I think, to really move up in the standings. Either that or they're going to have to be able to play very, very well, and a couple of the other teams are going to have to be really bad. And like you said, it's tough to think that somebody's going to be really bad unless some injuries really end up being a big issue for some teams, like the Blake Griffin injury.
Yeah, they'll probably have to go something like 24-5 to really move up, I would say. Unless, you know, some team really falls off, which could happen with injuries and so forth. All right, so, you know, anything else you want to talk about NBA-related or anything else before we wrap up here, Rob?
I think the one question I have about the NBA, and, you know, are you surprised at seemingly, at least record-wise, at how bad Miami is?
No, not at all. Dwayne Wade, you know, very good player, but not surprising at all that he missed a good amount of time. So once you consider that that was a likely scenario, you know, the team's just not all that good. Chris Bosh is a very good player still, but, you know, what's around him and Wade? I mean, you have okay players. Deng is okay, but he's clearly not as good as he used to be. Some people speculate because Thibodeau played him way too much that could be contributing to that issue. But, you know, you have Hassan Whiteside, who's come out of nowhere to be like a blocks and rebounding machine. But, yeah, it's just not a good team. So, no, not surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I would have thought that they would have been a little – I mean, I think when I saw their 20-27, I'm surprised that they're not more of a 500-ish team, especially in the East. Although I do think that the East has probably got some better teams than maybe we thought. Atlanta kind of becoming one of the best teams in the league, I think, does change the way you look at the East at least a little bit, especially compared to where you thought about them earlier in the season. Or I'm sorry, before the season started. You know, Milwaukee is several games above 500, I believe I saw, which, you know, that surprises me a little bit, especially with Parker being out. But, you know, for the most part, I mean, there are five pretty good teams in the East right now. And, you know, and there's, you know, probably two or three that, you know, are legitimately could beat one of the Western Conference teams in a seven-game series, I think. So I think the East is a little bit better than we thought it was going to be, and there's a little bit more upside in that conference, I think, than people thought.
Yeah, Milwaukee's legitimately a solid team, 30-23, won 8 of the last 10. You know, not necessarily a superstar, but they have a lot of good players. They have a lot of athleticism, the Greek Freak, John Henson, etc. Brandon Knight's a solid player. So, yeah, they have not missed the former Dookie, Jabari Parker, too much. But, you know, Jason Kidd also, you got to give him credit for what he's done there. So, you know, I think you have six legitimate, you know, good teams in the East, starting with Milwaukee and then Wizards, Cleveland, Chicago, Toronto, Atlanta. So, yeah, it's not horrible. It's obviously pales in comparison to the West, especially once you get past Milwaukee. I mean, Milwaukee wouldn't make the playoffs in the West. The Wizards, it would be very close. I don't know that they would. I kind of doubt that they would. So, you know, you have probably four teams in the East that would actually make the playoffs, but there's at least a couple other respectable teams. So, but yeah, the Heat, you know, the Wade issue is the main thing there, is you can't count on that guy to be healthy anymore. It's a shame, but I guess it was foreseeable, you know, based on what kind of player he was in his prime. Just, you know, they used to have the commercial where he kept on getting knocked down and he would get back up, and that was his style. He would just, like, in the when they won the title against the Mavericks, with him and Shaq, you know, he just went into the lane, like, relentlessly, and he got fouled a ridiculous amount of times in that series, and some of those fouls, I would say, in quotations, fouled, but, you know, whatever. He just sacrificed his body so much back then, and he never developed a good, you know, outside jump shot. So, you know, he's not the type of player who's going to age tremendously well, and you have the injury concerns due to his style of play.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt. I mean, it's you know, they're and Bosch has actually had a pretty good season, and you know, Whiteside is coming on as a guy that's maybe a potential good piece for them, you know, especially as the season, as this season goes on and his career goes on. He was a guy who, when he first was in college, was a projected high pick in the draft, and then, you know, he didn't really do a whole lot in college, if I remember correctly. He went to Marshall, if I'm remembering. And he just never really did much. So now all of a sudden he's starting to show a little bit. So, you know, that helps him. But I'm just a little surprised that they're not – I mean, I'm not tremendously different than what they are, but, you know, instead of 20 and 27, I'm surprised it's not, you know, maybe like a 24 and 23, 25 and 22 type thing, and not, like, clinging to making the playoffs, although, you know, they probably don't need to be 500 to make the playoffs in the East, since the bottom of the conference is so bad.
No, yeah, they're in the eighth spot right now at 22 and 30, one game up over the Brooklyn Nets, so, and then a game and a half up over the Celtics. Then you do have the Pistons, who have become interesting, you know, with Brandon Jennings going down. You know, that's unfortunate for them. And Indiana's actually been feisty. Give Frank Vogel a lot of credit for coaching them up. And Paul George, you know, he could come back this year, especially if they have a chance of making the playoffs. So, or if they do make the playoffs, maybe for the playoffs. So that could be interesting to see. Let me just, you know, go back to my first question to Michael real quick. It was about LeBron and the tweet about Kevin Love fitting in or not fitting in. So I'm, you know, known as a LeBron apologist on Bomber Sports and Life, at least by some. I will say that, you know, I don't think LeBron did a good job there in terms of leadership or whatever, being a good teammate. Weird tweet, you know, not too hard to figure out that it was about Kevin Love, and apparently he admitted that it was about Kevin Love to, like, some local media after denying it, but then he denied it again the next time he talked to media. So a very weird situation. He has not handled that well. Not to make a tweet into, like, some huge deal, but when you're a team leader, you know, you should be avoiding that type of thing. And the other thing is, I guess recently things have been better, but there's been a lot of talk that he's kind of really not allowed David Blatt to coach him and the team as much as, you know, Blatt probably should be able to, you know, as the actual coach of the team. He hasn't really embraced the offense that Blatt wants to run, and he's kind of, you know, usurped David Blatt in some cases here. So I'm not a big fan of those things about LeBron this season here with Cleveland.
I thought it was very strange when they signed LeBron that they brought in a coach before they signed him, and that the coach was somebody that nobody had really ever heard of. Now, that doesn't mean that Blatt can't be a great coach. It doesn't. I mean, you know, nobody had really heard of Eric Spoelstra either, and you know, he's turned out to be a wonderful coach. I mean, it doesn't mean any of that. It's just, I'm just very, very surprised, and obviously it didn't bother LeBron because he still signed there, but I also think LeBron probably knew that, you know, if this doesn't work out, I'm going to have the power to say, get this guy out of here and let's go get somebody else. So, he can't be – first of all, I agree with you about the tweet. It doesn't sound like it's a big deal between the players. You know, like, you know, Kevin Love, you know, at least publicly is saying he's fine with it. You know, him and LeBron are fine. but it's got to be an issue. And you know, Michael's point about the Andrew Wiggins thing and all is an interesting one. You know, I mean, they gave up a lot of team control, cheap salary, and that type of stuff. Now, I was for the move because it's kind of like, go win. But I expected a better fit. I expected them to use him better. And, you know, I was expecting him to sign there long term. And I think right now you can kind of look at that trade. I don't want to say the trade has been a bust because Kevin Love has been terrible. But I don't think Cleveland is any better off with Kevin Love than they would have been with Andrew Wiggins. And I would not have said that when they made the trade. I would have thought for sure that it was they were better off for this season, and maybe and then if Love was going to re-sign for the next couple of seasons with him than Andrew Wiggins. But I don't think that you can say that right now, especially since Wiggins is playing pretty well lately.
Well, the one thing is you have to consider fit, like Michael was saying. I totally agree with his point there. So that is talking about Andrew Wiggins too. If he was with Cleveland, he would not have been able to develop the same way. He would have been, you know, relegated to a much lower option offensively. And, you know, he plays some more positions as LeBron. So, and then you have Kyrie Irving as a, you know, a perimeter player as well. And, you know, I don't know that Wiggins would necessarily fit in tremendously well on offense. On defense, of course, he would, because, you know, you'd fit well on defense on any team. But, you know, I think Kevin Love, even though it's been awkward so far, in part because, you know, I think they're not doing a good job utilizing him, I think he still is a better fit for this team than Wiggins. But, yeah, when you factor in salary and future implications, you can certainly argue that the trade has backfired to this point.
Yeah, in Cleveland, it's going to be interesting to see what their long-term aspirations are going to be with LeBron. I mean, you know, they've got Kyrie locked up. You've got LeBron. He's not really locked up per se, but he's going to be once the new TV contract is out. So you've got those two. So what else are you going to do? I mean, you've traded away Waiters. You traded away Wiggins. I don't know if they've got Mozgov for a little while. I would think he's still, you know, under some control for at least another season or so. So, you know, and he's been a nice piece for them. So, you know, the question is going to be is, you know, what else are they going to be able to put around the rest of that team going forward, that whereas, you know, they could have maybe had something with Wiggins or whatever. So that's going to be interesting. But, you know, LeBron, going back to your original point, LeBron has kind of got a, you know, I think he's trying to be Jordan in that, you know, he's trying to, you know, he'll say whatever he needs to get his players motivated, and MJ used to do that all the time. So I think LeBron is trying to do that. I just don't know if he's going to be able to do it and have the results the same way. So it'll be interesting to see that. And Kevin Love, some of this is going to have to be, he's going to have to, you know, he's going to have to swallow some of his pride and do certain things. And, you know, and David Blatt's going to he's just going to have to use him better. I mean, Michael talked about how he thought he'd use him on pick and rolls, and you had agreed with that and things like that. So, you know, they've got to learn to use him a little bit more and not just have him be a guy that's going to stand outside on the three-point line and do nothing else. I mean, you know, he's not going to get as many rebounds if all he's doing is camping out over there. So you're hurting some of his game by the way you're using him as well, and that falls on the coach.
Sure. Unfortunately, I think it probably falls on LeBron to some degree, too, because, again, I think LeBron is kind of using his power because, let's face it, obviously LeBron has much more power than does David Blatt. So, you know, I think he's kind of getting his way a lot in terms of how the offense is run. So, yeah, I think LeBron overall, from, you know, what I know, has done a great job in his career as far as being a teammate and also being a leader. But, yeah, this year, from, you know, again, what I know, which is a pretty limited amount, but not quite as thrilled with, you know, the leadership angle here. But, you know, it's hard to really look too much into that with any player because we only know so much. But, you know, things are working out pretty well for Cleveland now. J.R. Smith fitting in really well. Mozgov has played quite well. Shumpert, you know, hasn't, you know, gotten involved a ton yet, but he's a potential asset, plays good defense, so... You know, I think this Cleveland team has definitely improved themselves a lot for this season, giving themselves a better chance of, at, you know, getting out of the East and then competing with the gets out of the West. All right, so everyone, thanks for listening. We appreciate it, and have a good evening.